Okay, please be seated, everybody, and we'll call our first case, which is case number, I get seated and calling first. Here we go. So our first case is case number 59752, Deja Vu Showgirls of Las Vegas LLC et al. Versus Nevada Department of Taxation et al. Mr. Ferrario for the appellants, Mr. Pope for the respondents. Mr. Ferrario, you may proceed. And do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal in this first case here?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Very well.
That's acceptable.
Okay. You may proceed. Go ahead.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mark Ferrario appearing along with Brad Schaefer and Will Brown on behalf of the appellants. We were joking. We drew straws, and I got the, I think, the short end of the stick here today. I have the exciting procedural argument to begin things here today. In going back through the briefing, I think this really breaks down into two sections. The first section is that I'd like to address is why the filing of the action back in January of 08 was appropriate. And then the second part of my argument will address the application of the Edison case to the facts presented in our case. It is unusual where you come before the court and you have a case like Edison that was recently decided where you address an issue very similar to the one that I have here. So you're familiar with the history, and I'm not going to go back through that. But I think what we need to focus on is the history of this case. This action was commenced in January of 08. And it proceeded through the court process for over 3 years. During that period of time, I think it's important to recognize that this state never came forward, not until 2011, and made the claim that we were, in effect, in the wrong place doing the wrong thing, that there was no jurisdiction for the court to hear this claim. And that is borne out in the record, and I don't have to go back through that. We've laid it out in our briefing. So for 3+ years, we're litigating this case as a de novo action in the district court, and the state is, in effect, playing along. Not only are they playing along, they're aggressively defending the claims that we make. Another thing that's important to recognize in the context of this case is we ended up in federal court, as you know from reading the briefs. And when we were in federal court, the issue to be decided there was whether or not we had a plain and clear, speedy remedy in state court. What did the state do when they were in federal court? The state came forward and they said, "You can go, we have two complaints going in state court." They didn't say one of them was wrong. They didn't say we didn't need to be there. They didn't say it should have been a petition for judicial review. They present both of the complaints that were on file at the time in case one and case two to the federal court, being illustrative of the remedies that we had available in state court. So why did they do that? You have to ask that question. Why did they do that? I think they did that because if you look at Chapter 368A, they knew that we were following the appropriate procedure. 368A and the remedies provided therein, which we've cited to you, clearly lays out that we can file an action in district court to seek a refund. That's exactly what we did. One thing you will not find in the state's brief is any citation to anything that we did that runs afoul of the statute or runs afoul of any of your precedent prior to Edison. You will not find that because the state knew that what we were doing was appropriate. 368A has set forth within its own section, the light entertainment tax section, the procedure to follow when you're going to challenge a determination. Okay, and in that section, 368A, which is different than the sales and use tax that you dealt with in Edison, they use the term plaintiff. They don't use the term petitioner. Now, the state kind of poo-poos that, saying, well, that's not a big deal. I think it is a big deal. Because the LET tax was enacted after the amendments to the Administrative Procedure Act that you highlight in Edison. Our legislature knew that those sections of the APA had been modified. Our legislature knew that there was the section 6 of 233B, I think it's 020, that said this is the exclusive remedy. Our legislature didn't reference 233B in the LET. They set forth their own processes, their own procedures. We followed them to the letter. We filed the action, which is a de novo action, which is consistent with all of your precedent prior to that. And based upon all of those factors and how the state conducted themselves in this case, I think it's very clear that our action should not have been dismissed by Judge Gonzalez. And so that's the first part of my argument. And we've set out all of the distinguishing characteristics in our brief, which now leads me to Edison. This court was faced with a decision in the Edison case that had to be made in trying to reconcile a lot of conflicting precedent, but more importantly, conflicting procedures that were being employed by the state is how I'll refer to that. And this court goes through in Edison in great detail what the Department of Taxation was doing and the confusion that was wrought because of the department's belief that you could proceed it with an action de novo to challenge and to get a refund of taxes. And you went through that in great detail. In fact, you cite to an administrative law judge that says go ahead and file a de novo action. You talk about the change in policy at the state level in Edison. And when you looked at all of this in Edison, you said, well, the way I read the case anyhow, I'm not going to presume to tell you what you said, the way I read the case is we kind of need to clean this up, okay? We have the Administrative Procedure Act. The Administrative Procedure Act, the way you read it and the amendments thereto, should be the exclusive avenue to follow when you're going to challenge an agency decision. Yes, there are some provisions within the sales and use tax, again, a remedy provision that talks about filing an action. They use there the word petitioner. They don't use plaintiff. And in an effort to reconcile everything and kind of tell the world anew how we're going to go forward, this court says in Edison, everything now is going to go under the APA. So if you're going to challenge an action of the tax commission, you're going to follow the APA. And you're going to do that via a petition for judicial review. And that's what this court says in Edison. But then the court has to struggle with something. Edison didn't do anything wrong. The appellant there didn't do anything wrong. They followed existing precedent. They followed the dictates of the department. This court looked at that and said it would be unfair, simply unfair, to punish Edison, given the confusion that existed within the case law, given the confusion within the statutes, but more importantly, given the confusion created by the state in the conflicting positions that the state had taken over the years in dealing with these types of issues. And in addressing that, the court said, we're going to allow, based upon judicial estoppel and other equitable grounds, we're going to allow Edison to proceed as an action de novo. And I submit that was 100% the right call. Because on the Edison record, it would have been patently unfair to penalize Edison for doing what many before had done in reliance on what the state had articulated as being the appropriate procedure. So what then happens? This court issues Edison. We've now litigated in state court for over 3 years. The state hasn't come in. They didn't come in right out of the chute in 08 and say, wait a minute, there's no jurisdiction here. They litigate, and we highlight in our brief how they've engaged in discovery. We highlight in our brief how we are actually taken to task by the state for not complying with Rule 16.1 when we filed our action for a refund claim and we asserted an as-applied challenge in our de novo action. So far from chastising us for being in the wrong place, they're chastising us for not giving them discovery. They don't say we shouldn't be here. They say we're not playing by the rules. So we're sitting down there in district court, we've laid out the process that ensued beginning in early January, leading to a motion being denied, then a motion for rehearing, and then your decision in Edison. And we are now, in effect, probably one of the first cases, if not the first case, that has to deal with what happens now that you have decided Edison. And the state presents Edison to the district court, and the district court says, based upon my reading of the Edison case, I think that you must now proceed by way of a petition for judicial review. And we argue that we're in effect Edison, and that's not appropriate. You can't prejudice us. You can't saddle us with the record that was created based upon our reliance on what the state had done. You can't deprive us of our rights to discovery and our rights to develop a full record and bring this to the court. And Judge Gonzalez feels constrained by the dictates of this court in the Edison case, and she dismisses our action but allows us 30 days to file a petition for judicial review. And I don't have to educate this court on the very real differences between proceeding by way of a petition for judicial review and the limited analysis that the courts have in that context. Quite frankly, the very inadequate record that exists because we never did get to finish our discovery versus what we would be able to create via pursuing our action de novo. So we present this to the court. Judge Gonzalez feels constrained to follow your decision in Edison, and she dismisses. So if this court does not agree that the LET process that's laid out within the context of the statute, okay, provides a separate avenue to challenge a finding of the tax commission in the LET context via a de novo action, then we're left with how do you apply Edison to a litigant or litigants such as the clients that I represent that are in exactly the same place as the claimant in Edison. And I submit that's a very easy decision for this court to make. And the same rule that applied in Edison should apply here. It is almost on all fours. We relied on existing precedent from this court as to what we should do. There's no shortage of lawyers representing this group. And as this case is on all fours with Edison in terms of applying equitable relief, this court should apply that doctrine here, and we should be able to proceed via our action de novo. And I'll reserve the rest of my
time. Thank you very much. Mr. Pope?
Morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. David Pope, Senior Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the appellees, who I'm going to refer to generally as the department. There are three main points that I'd like to discuss, and they're going to respond to most of the comments made by Mr. Ferrario. The first is that the clubs are really glossing over something really very important, and that is that their issues are receiving and or will receive both district court and Supreme Court review, similar to treatment given to other taxpayers, and not inconsistent with what was argued before the federal courts. The other two points are that waiver and judicial estoppel do not apply in this case. So with regard to receiving similar treatment, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, found at 360-291, says that taxpayers are to be treated similarly. Then in the Edison decision, it was determined that by harmonizing NRS 360-245 and NRS 233-B-135, that all final decisions of the Nevada Tax Commission were to proceed as petitions for judicial review. And after issuing that decision, this court decided two other cases that had similar motions to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And those motions in those cases were filed for the same reason that the taxpayers had not filed petitions for judicial review. Those cases are Supreme Court case number 56722 and 56740, one involving Harrah's Operating Company, one involving NV Energy. The district courts in those cases had denied the motions to dismiss. This court granted the department's writ petitions and directed that those matters proceed as petitions for judicial review. And so with regard to the clubs, the district court in this case was made aware of those cases, granted the clubs the same treatment, and that was not erroneous. That was in line with your decision in Edison as well as with the Malecon decision.
Counsel, you've heard the argument that was presented as to Edison, that because of the actions of the department, they should be treated like Edison and be allowed to proceed de novo. What's your response?
Okay, well, I think there were two parts to that, Your Honor. One would have been waiver and one would be judicial estoppel. And I can take them in that order. With regard to waiver, NRCP 12H3 and the related case law cited in the department's briefing established that the issue of subject matter jurisdiction is not waived and it can be raised for the first time on appeal. And in this case, it was raised before appeal. The department had an affirmative defense in its answer of failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and the department brought one of those motions. And as we know from Harris and the NV Energy cases, such a motion is an appropriate way to challenge the procedural posture of a case.
The assertion, more specifically, is they're asserting you led them along, i.e., like in Edison, because you were in district court for 3 years, you didn't assert 233B judicial review.
In this case, Your Honor, there were a couple of procedural things that made it a little difficult to know exactly when to bring the motion, particularly, through the federal proceedings, the clubs were arguing for a facial challenge, that they brought a facial case and that they wanted a facial exception to the Tax Injunction Act. Then in state court, the first complaint that they filed was a facial challenge. Same as with the second complaint in this case. They filed a facial challenge, as evidenced by the fact that they had to amend the complaint to include an as-applied challenge. So after that amended complaint was filed and the department was served with those, or with it, the department amended its answer with several additional affirmative defenses addressing this issue of the club's failure to file a petition for judicial review. And, you know, until that point in time, they were pursuing a facial challenge. In addition, with regard to any claim of surprise or that, you know, that it's not fair, the rule, 12H3, says whenever it appears, by suggestion of the parties or otherwise, that there's a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, the court has to dismiss the case. That word whenever means that issue can be raised at any time, and the court can dismiss the case at any time. It's the plaintiff's burden to be able to show that there's subject matter jurisdiction throughout the proceedings. So that's really something that they have to be able to show. The department didn't lead them along. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
With regard to discovery, because there was an allegation that the department participated in discovery, all the discovery, as we put in our brief, all the discovery was going on in case one. In case, the department didn't propound discovery in case two until after the district court had denied its motion to dismiss. And at that point in time, the court was telling us, this is going to be a trial de novo. We had extended discovery a couple times. The discovery deadline was coming up again, so we were just, you know, adapting to the posture of the case. It was time for us to do discovery if we were going to do it. So we didn't lead them along.
Mr. Pope, in Edison, we were interpreting 372.680. The claim for refund statute in this case is 368A.290. While the language in both is quite similar, although I don't see the plaintiff distinction that Mr. Ferrario mentioned in his argument. My reading of the statute uses the word claimant in both, so maybe I've missed something there. But since this would be the first case involving a different tax, not a use tax, but an LET tax, and this statute, shouldn't we apply the same approach we took in Edison, which is if we are going to be consistent and require petitions for judicial review of this kind of tax under this statute, that to the extent that the parties have engaged in a history of litigation leading up to it, does it require some equitable treatment or relief?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I have a couple reasons why. First of all, I believe that this court was going to, my reading of the Edison decision is that it was going to apply to Edison but for judicial estoppel. Mm-hmm. And I'll get to why judicial estoppel doesn't apply in this case. In addition, the decision in Edison said, we're going to take this opportunity to clarify the existing procedure. And when you're clarifying an existing procedure...
One of the things that helped in that circumstance was some legislative history in 372-680. I don't think there's any legislative history on how 368A-290 would work. So there is a little bit of a difference, even though the language is similar. Perhaps you could address that.
With regard to the meaning of the language that's used in 372-680, Your Honor, the legislature spent 10 years making changes to Chapter 360, Chapter 233B, Chapter 372 to give that statute the meaning that they wanted it to have.
Mm-hmm.
They then, in 2003, had to adopt three new taxes in a special session in a financial emergency. I think it's a really hard sell to say that the statutory language that the legislature was working on for 10 years, that was most likely the freshest in its mind because it was only a session later, mm-hmm. and for which they adopted into Chapter 363A, 363B, and 368A, was going to mean anything other than what this court decided it meant in Edison.
Does it make a difference if the court concludes that an LET tax is different than a sales tax? The nature of the taxes that are imposed might drive a different outcome?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
I don't see any reason why. And another point with regard to the meaning of the statute and why I think it's the same as what the court said it is in 372-680 is because there's nothing clear in the legislative history that the legislature would have intended that language to mean anything other than what it means in 372-680. So it means a petition for judicial review, and to say that it means something else I think leads to an absurd result because then the sales and use tax is going to be one thing and the LET is going to be another. They're both in the same title and they're both administered by the Department of Taxation.
In the two cases that you mentioned to us earlier and were presented to Judge Gonzalez, Harris Operating and the other one, those were sales and use tax cases, were they not?
Yes, they were.
And 372-680 claims as opposed to claims under 368A?
Yes, they were.
But concerning those cases, they also didn't present the estoppel issue that Edison and arguably this case present, right? I mean, they were coming up on a petition by the department for a writ of mandamus or prohibition that challenged an order, and I'm reading from one of them, that a use tax refund should proceed in the district court as an independent action rather than as a petition for judicial review. So the department was the petitioner.
That's correct.
Arguing that the district court erred when it allowed it to proceed and it should go as a petition for judicial review. So it didn't have the estoppel issue in it that Edison in this case had, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
and the same thing is true of the, that was the Harris one. And the other one is Sierra Pacific, right?
Yes, and V Energy.
Right. And the problem, we shouldn't be citing unpublished decisions under Rule 123, but if we're going to, they're really not the same. Even disputing, as you do, Justice Hardesty's point.
Well, Your Honor, two points. The clubs in their opposition to our motion in the district court, and I could cite to it if you would like me to, said that those two cases were highly relevant because they argued alternatively, either treat us the same or let us have a trial de novo. And they actually are the same because judicial estoppel doesn't apply in this case. And that's because the department hasn't taken two positions. Before the federal courts, the department was arguing that the available remedies were adequate. And the department cited to applicable case law and said, look, well, all we have to show is that these constitutional issues are going to be heard, and then they're going to be reviewed by the district court and the Supreme Court. And that same case law said it's okay if exhaustion of administrative remedies is required, and it also instructed that the totality of the remedies was to be reviewed. So The department then went on to describe how Chapter 368A provided for an administrative refund procedure that resulted in a final decision from the commission, which was then reviewed by the district court pursuant to NRS 233, 233B-135, which is the standard of review for a petition for judicial review. And that same quote that's in our brief said that the matter would then come to this court pursuant to 233B-150. The department then discussed exceptions to the exhaustion requirement. And exceptions are just that. They're exception to a rule, the rule being exhaustion followed by a petition for judicial review. And, you know, the department continued that argument in the Ninth Circuit, contrary to some allegations in the brief, by saying the clubs have an opportunity to be heard at the administrative level and in court making a claim for refund. So it's acknowledging both procedures. And then the department also argued that the law makes the issue of constitutionality, a basis for refund at the administrative level, fully reviewable on all legal grounds, including constitutionality, in the courts. And that's at the appellant's appendix, volume 16, at page 3035. And so that review, I mean, when you're talking about the totality of the remedies, and the rule is exhaustion, and that's followed by a petition for judicial review, and 233B-135 has been cited.
Mr. Pope, when I read this in the record and in your brief, I thought how prophetic. The department was talking about Edison some 6 years before we decided it. But the question I had is, then why didn't you advance this argument articulated in a brief in 2006 to the district court
because
in the many years subsequent?
Sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right.
Okay, so, you know, the department wasn't discussing Edison 6 years in advance, but what the department was...
The rule, I mean, it's pretty consistent.
Well, the rule, you know, the rule is there. It's judicial review. That's administrative law.
I guess the simple question is, if you advanced this position in front of the Ninth Circuit in 2006, and appropriately so, why didn't the department advance this very legal position in motions to dismiss the state court proceedings in the many years since?
Because the department had cited to the case law that said the court's supposed to look at the totality of the remedies. So the department is talking about exhaustion and a petition for judicial review, and is talking about exceptions to the exhaustion requirement. And the clubs, you know, they came into this case telling the federal courts that we have a facial challenge. We want a facial exception to the Tax Injunction Act. And they pointed to the anti-injunction statute in Chapter 368A and said that we're not sure we're going to get declaratory relief. And so they really kind of focused the argument on that, I think, trying to get a commitment that there was going to be a trial de novo. But the department didn't take that position because the department's argument before the federal court was to say this is the totality of our remedies that are available. And so the department didn't take two positions. The department took the position that these are our available remedies. You get a PJR through the administrative system or exceptions to the exhaustion requirement. And it was up to the clubs to assert one of those remedies. They hadn't pursued any of the state remedies at that point in time. And kind of lost my thought there.
You can go ahead and sum up then.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, the waiver of judicial estoppel apply in this case. The club's issues are all receiving a review and or will be reviewed by the district court and the Supreme Court. The district court's order is not erroneous, and this appeal should be denied.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Farr, you have a little under 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mm-hmm.
While you're coming up, the question I'm going to have is similar to the one I asked him, which is, you're arguing judicial estoppel under Edison applying to your case, but in Edison, there were kind of two things cited as a basis for judicial estoppel. One, the fact that in many cases the department had taken different positions on APA versus statutory issues. But also in that particular case, the department had written letters and briefs and so on that asserted the position that they would have a right to bring a lawsuit. And I don't see in this case the second category of of record evidence that they tried to wrong foot you in this case particularly. Can you tell me where that evidence is?
Your Honor, we don't have, and actually Mr. Brown leaned over to me and asked what is a significant difference between Edison in this case, and I really don't think there is one. I don't have something that's as clear as the one memo that you're referencing in Edison. It doesn't exist here. But what I do have, and it's interesting that you bring up the federal case, Justice Hardesty, when they went to the Ninth Circuit, the state omitted any reference to 233B in the Ninth Circuit briefing. They didn't assert that at the Ninth Circuit level. And I think, you know, and you asked a very good question, why didn't you raise this? You answered that question in Edison. You acknowledged that the state, and this gets to your point as well, Justice Pickering, the state changed its policy in 2009. So whether it was a memo in the Edison case or just a realization that the policy that existed at the state level was to file a petition or an action de novo, it's the same thing.
But that would be a species, really, of agency estoppel rather than judicial estoppel, right?
I think that's kind of where my reading of your decision in Edison says you can look to those things, which is what you did in Edison. You looked beyond the record in Edison. You said, on a global basis, what is the state doing? And you acknowledged through the reference to the administrative law judge telling people they could do that, to the state changing its policy, all of that applies equally to us. And you actually, and there was another great question that was raised, and this is the first time you're going to deal with this issue in the context of the LET. And the LET is different than the sales and use tax section. The LET is administered both by the gaming regulators and by the state. It is a dual system. It is a statute that started as the casino entertainment tax, then morphed into the LET with dual enforcement. It is much different. And they provided specific remedies in 368A, which we've cited, and Justice Hardesty, it's 368A-300 where the reference to plaintiff is found. Plaintiff can recover the money. And then to go back to what the state was doing, and you can cut through all of the briefing and the parsing of words, I go back to what was the state doing in our case? What representations were they making? Here's what the state said, and this is at page 8 of our brief. The discovery is relevant to the defense of the claims in the plaintiff's amended complaints. They were asking for discovery. And then on page 9 of our brief, the state chastises us for not complying with the rules because our complaint included an as-applied challenge. They knew that. So those are representations, I think, Justice Pickering, that go to the level of what you found in Edison. So when all is said and done, we are Edison. If you don't agree with my argument that this case should break from Edison and that you should apply 368A and the remedies provided therein to provide for a judicial de novo, we are Edison in the LET context, plain and simple. And so if you're going to apply that rationale here, the same rationale you employed in Edison should be applied here, and we should be allowed to go forward as an action de novo. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ferrario, and appreciate you both. Excellent arguments and briefs from both parties, and this case will stand submitted.